You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 1st of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
The sentiment has been popular that, Assad is the devil we know and God knows who comes after him. Regardless of how somebody wants the war to play out, there's always universal support for Israel maintaining its military edge.
From Israeli strikes in Syria to anti-US outrage in Asia, Jane Kinnemont and Raphael Pantucci are here to unpack all of the day's top news stories. Then we take a look at this year's top films from Iran as the 4th London Iranian Film Festival launches today. But as with most Iranian creative pursuits, it's all about walking a fine political line.
When it comes to Iran or Iranians, everything, in my opinion, is political. Us running the film festival, we've tried very hard to stay on that very thin line in between, and thank God we've managed to, you know, stay there for 4 years.
And we'll head to Vienna's renowned Leopold Museum, which lost its director this week following a row over the museum's world-famous Klimt collection.
Elizabeth Leopold is actually the widow of the collector Leopold, and she doesn't know what to do. She's old. So we're all watching and waiting.
All that, plus a bit of music, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck, starting right now. So that's rather a lot ahead in the next hour on Aperitivo. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Muslim Brotherhood supporters have staged protests around Egypt today in support of the deposed President Mohamed Morsi ahead of his scheduled trial on Monday. In Alexandria, 7 people were wounded after residents clashed with Morsi supporters today before security forces intervened. 13 Islamists were arrested. Fighting also erupted in the capital, Cairo. Morsi supporters say his trial is illegitimate. The charges against him relate to the deaths of about a dozen people in clashes outside the presidential palace in December after he enraged his opponents with a decree expanding his powers. Morsi has been held in a secret location since July. Iran's foreign minister says his country does not seek a nuclear weapons program. Speaking at a two-day conference on science and world affairs in Istanbul, Mohammad Javad Zarif called on the West to accept a peaceful uranium enrichment program for Iran. China, France, Britain, Russia and the United States, the 5 permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, and Germany said in February they want Iran to shut down its enrichment facilities. Mr. Zarif said it was time to build trust between Iran and the P5 plus one nations.
We need to follow a single objective. That is, Iran should make the objective, or at least the stated objective of the Western members of 5 plus one, that Iran should never have nuclear weapons as its own objective. And I believe the West should accept Iran's objective that it should have a peaceful enrichment program as its own objective.
The head of the Pakistani Taliban has been killed by US drone strike in Pakistan on Friday, the latest in a series of blows to the country's most feared militant group. Hakimullah Massoud, who was one of Pakistan's most wanted men, has been reported dead several times before. But late on Friday, several intelligence, army and militant sources and the Pakistani Taliban did confirm he had been killed in a drone strike in the lawless North Waziristan region. In Canada, Toronto police said they have obtained a video that appears to match one that allegedly shows the city's mayor, Rob Ford, smoking crack cocaine, but they won't confirm what the video shows or say if they are contemplating charges against him. Ford, however, insists he did not use the illegal drug. Speaking before the media, he said he regretted the fact that he could not publicly defend himself. Despite constant questioning by reporters, he still insisted he would not resign.
I'm not going to get into the evidence of this case, but I can tell you that the digital video file that we have recovered depicts images which are consistent with those that had previously been reported in the press.
A drug smuggling super tunnel has been discovered by U.S. officials linking Tijuana in Mexico to San Diego. Authorities say it would have cost millions of dollars to complete. 8.5 tons of marijuana and 327 pounds of cocaine were seized during the raid. 3 men were also arrested. The tunnel linked warehouses in Tijuana and San Diego's Ote Mesa industrial area, while U.S. attorney Laura Duffy said authorities were pleased with their success.
We're going after the management now as well. In February of 2012, we charged Jose Sanchez Villalobos, who is identified in court documents as one of the senior lieutenants of the Sinaloa cartel, with building, financing, and operating two of the super tunnels that we've mentioned. One that was discovered in November of 2010, and the other precisely a year later.
And finally, bidding on a painting by graffiti artist Banksy that shows a Nazi staring at a landscape has now reached $610,000 at the close of an auction by a New York charity for AIDS patients and the homeless. The anonymous British artist, who has been surprising New Yorkers with artwork around the city throughout the month of October, dropped off the painting titled The Banality of the Banality of Evil at a New York thrift store on Tuesday, which promptly put it up for auction online. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Are you bidding?
I think the bidding is now closed. I don't think I have $610,000. That's the problem.
I don't have the wall space. That's my problem. They seem rather big, those. I'm amazed, actually, the following that he has now on both sides of the Atlantic. At least he's doing something for charity. Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're going to be back in 25 minutes with more news for us. And you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're going to be right back just after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Aperitivo. The time here in London now is 18.07, which means it's 14.07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Jane Kinnemont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, and Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI. Welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
But we're going to start with the news that's been breaking just over the last couple of hours, which is obviously coming out of Pakistan, which is the news which seems to be almost confirmed now that the Pakistani Taliban leader, Hakimullah Massoud, has been killed in a drone attack. First of all, I'll pick this up with you, Raffaello. Do we think this will have any impact, actually, if it's true? Because, you know, they're going after these kind of lead characters, but it seems to be such a many-headed hydra. You take one person out, it hasn't really kind of dimmed the prospects of the Taliban so far.
Well, it's a very complicated question. And, you know, while it looks like this time it's actually being confirmed, because we've had the group itself say that he's been killed, and they've sort of said his funeral, I think, is going to be Miran Shah tomorrow. The thing is that we've seen when leaders like this in Pakistan, when we're talking about TTP in particular, have been droned, it has tended to lead to the rise of other leaders who have been more violent sometimes. So it hasn't necessarily actually resolved the problem. There's been a debate recently within Pakistan about whether they were going to open talks with the TTP. And Hakimullah Massoud had done an interview with the BBC in which he had hinted that he might be willing to move in this direction. So it's unclear exactly what taking him onto the battlefield will mean for these sorts of potential talks.
Jane, I'd like to pick that point up with you because it is really intriguing. Here we have Pakistan saying, please kind of desist from these drone attacks. It's not helping us. You know, the Pakistani government wants to engage with the Taliban to see if it can negotiate some kind of peace. And here you have the kind of lead figure taken out. Do you imagine that if you're sitting in Islamabad, you're thinking, oh, this is bad news?
Well, there's a huge public resentment of drone attacks. They're seen as a violation of sovereignty, and of course they end up killing innocent civilians. So when we had the Pakistani elections earlier this year, one of the main popular issues that politicians were riding on was public opposition to these actions by the US. Might be a tactical success, but there's a big question about the strategy.
And do you think it will kind of set back potentially the opportunity for peace talks, even if we believe those may be tricky?
I think it potentially does. I mean, obviously there's violence going in both directions, so it wouldn't necessarily make them impossible.
Well, I'm sure we're going to be following that story over the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. As we said, it seems to have been confirmed that the Pakistani Taliban leader, Hakimullah Massoud, has been killed in a drone attack, along with certainly two of his bodyguards as well. But we're going to turn now to Syria, where it appears that Israeli fighter jets have bombed a stockpile of Russian-made rockets, which were destined for the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. This all happened near the country's largest coastal city, Latakia. A bit earlier, we heard from Ben Hartman of the Jerusalem Post, who gave us the Israeli reaction to the strike.
Well, there's different kind of feelings about it. I think when the chemical weapons story came out back in August, you started to see more support for an American strike, or at least people talking about wanting to see an American strike as some sort of, you know, a way to show that there's American deterrence in the Middle East and Israeli deterrence in the Middle East. But by and large, you've seen a kind of sort of ambiguous sort of approach to the Syrian war. It's been popular for people to say, or the sentiment has been popular, that, you know, Assad is the devil we know and God knows who comes after him. But regardless of how somebody wants the war to play out, there's always universal support for Israel maintaining its military edge in the region and its ability to deter people from using weapons on its civilians and from really serious weapons and whatnot getting into Hezbollah. So there's certainly support for that. I would say, though, in a political sense, there's now the fifth such strike, or alleged strike, let's say, over the last year. And by now, you know, the first one, it was a big story. The second one, less story. By the fifth time, you know, it's in and out of the news cycle real quick, because now it's just kind of, it becomes kind of routine.
Jane, let's just pick up what was said in that little clip there from Ben Hartman, this idea of the devil they knew. And you do kind of wonder for kind of all of the leaders around the world who now they see there hasn't been a quick resolution to this issue in Syria. Do you think that they are kind of slightly missing the days of Assad, when they knew what the power balance was in the region, and that, you know, these attacks by the likes of Israel trying to kind of equalize things on the ground are just trouble for everybody, really?
Certainly in the West, we've been seeing more and more of a sense that maybe Assad isn't so bad, because we've seen this increasingly al-Qaeda-looking face of the opposition, although that too is a massive simplification of what the complex reality of Syria. Israel may be shifting the other way. I think, as Ben was saying, initially in Israel, their views were very divided over it. After all, this had been their quietest border for the past 40 years, as Israeli analysts would point out. But since Hezbollah became directly involved in Syria, I think we have started to see the Israeli defence establishment shifting towards thinking, actually, Hezbollah and Iran and Assad together are the main enemy here. Al-Qaeda could be a headache, but they're not as substantial a threat.
Rafael, what's also interesting is just this conspiracy of silence we get. You know, the Israelis never comment on it. Mm. You know, the Syrians don't react publicly. You know, the Russians certainly aren't going to kind of say, oh yes, those were our arms. We know that we're on the way to Hezbollah. Why is it in everyone's interest to keep their mouth shut?
Well, I mean, we've seen this repeatedly over the years when we're dealing with strikes like this. I think it was in 2006 when there was that famous Israeli strike on the Syrian nuclear reactor, which I think was being built by North Korean engineers.
Yes.
And it's happened out of the blue. They managed somehow to take out all of Syria's air defences with some sort of crazy cyber attack and then strike the site and leave. And, you know, no one said anything about this. It sort of leaked out in the press and weird rumours. And then years and years later, we got sort of confirmation. I think the point is that this entire region, and particularly when we're dealing with Israel and its relationship with these countries nearby, they do seem to be perennially caught in these sorts of shadow wars and these shadow fights, which involves these sorts of moves that happen and people admit or don't admit or acknowledge, because it's in no one's interest to admit that we're involved in a full-fledged war here. Better to keep it at this level of these sorts of strategic strikes, which deal with a specific problem And, you know, someone's been caught doing something that maybe they shouldn't have been doing. Hezbollah taking weapons out, which maybe could have been used against Israel in some other way. And you know, then maybe coming from Russia, you know, should the Russians have been watching out for their missiles more? There's a whole set of sort of issues here that are really quite awkward. And so it's in everyone's interest just to sort of let this one slip past.
And Jane, for you, do you think the Russians probably knew where their armaments were going, or they're just kind of tipping them into the horrible melting pot of the war in Syria and seeing where they end up?
I don't think they'd be wildly surprised, nor do I think anyone's going to be wildly surprised by this latest Israeli action. But it is fascinating how these attacks have been repeated and haven't escalated.
And do you think that it's because Assad, you know, in a way, is just too weak to react to Israel and doesn't want to provoke, you know, he's got enough going on without kind of reacting against what Israel does? Or do you think that down the line there may be some reaction from the Syrians?
Well, as Raffaello said, this happened a few years ago, well before the Syrian uprising, when Syria's army had nothing else to preoccupy it, but nonetheless didn't want to take on the better functioning Israeli army. So I think there has been a deterrence established with Israel that's held for a long time, but there is obviously uncertainty in Syria.
Right. Well, let's stay in the region, because while Iran has been one of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's strongest supporters, Turkey has been one of its fiercest critics, funneling aid to the opposition and rebel fighters. Yet, ever since the more moderate Iranian President Hassan Rouhani was elected in June, the strategic calculus is showing signs of change. Rouhani has expressed some concern over the rise of al-Qaeda in Syria. So, has Turkey and Iran found common ground? Is a rapprochement in sight? What do you think, Raffaello?
I think this is another equally complex issue. I mean, the whole Syria conversation and sort of what's been happening there is one that's incredibly complicated. Being it on the ground, as Jane pointed out, in terms of who the opposition actually are, it's not really all al-Qaeda. Some are, some aren't. That whole complicated picture, Hezbollah's involvement, and then the sort of relationships between the outside powers. I suspect what we're seeing here is a sort of echo of the rapprochement that we've been seeing between the US and Iran more broadly. Turkey, I think, has offered itself sometimes as a bit of a go-between in some of these discussions. And I suspect that what we're seeing here is a sort of reflection of that. I think it's early days, probably. I think the interesting thing to note is that here they refer to the fact that Iran may be involved in this Geneva 2 discussion that's been held. But from my perspective, and you know, I know Jane knows an awful lot about this conversation, it seems to me that the problem with Geneva 2 is really not about the sort of great powers who will be around the table, but more about who on the opposition side is actually going to show up and who they're actually speaking for. So it seems to me that these sorts of geopolitical games is probably, you know, echoes of other things, but whether it's going to lead to anything practical on the ground in Syria, I remain to be convinced.
And Jane, what do you think the Iranians want out of this? You know, why would they start being nicer to the Turks? You know, they're doing quite well, aren't they? What they want in the region is kind of happening. That, you know, Bashar al-Assad hasn't gone anywhere. They have, you know, still remarkable influence out the region. Plus, now they're now being treated better on the world stage as well, thanks to Rouhani.
That's true, especially the reactions to Rouhani. But at the same time, Iran didn't start this conflict in Syria. It's not something it had a strategic plan for. It got essentially sucked into it. I'm not saying they had no choice. I'm not trying to justify their levels of engagement. But it's something that where the uprising, I think, took them too by surprise, and it's costly. The entry of Iran and Hezbollah into this conflict has really led to a sectarian polarization in the region. They may have solidified a lot of Shia groups behind them, but the majority of the Middle East are Sunni Muslims. And, you know, Iran previously, they'd been trying to build links with Arab Spring movements, with the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth. That's all been shot to pieces because of Syria. So it has costs for Iran too.
And do you think the Iranians are concerned that that kind of sectarianism could cross the border into Iran as well?
They absolutely are. I mean, first of all, there's the direct worry about al-Qaeda. And one of the ways they try to justify their role in Syria to their own population is by saying, if we don't fight al-Qaeda in Syria, we'll be fighting it here in Iran, especially in the Arab areas, ethnically Arab areas of Iran. But also more broadly, they want to be influential in the Middle East. And if they're seen as a sectarian power, at the end of the day, they're in the sectarian minority. So they've always tried to have a more pan-Islamic appeal and also to appeal to kind of third worldism, you know, being friends with Chavez and Russia and so forth, to appeal to leftists.
And just quickly, Raffaella, do you think that this, you know, in a way gives the Turks a get out of jail card because, you know, they're kind of squeezed on every side? Do you think this will allow them to get out?
I think that the Turks have been playing a very tricky game, frankly, with Syria. You know, if they're now talking to the sort of Iranian side, having basically let their borders be a sort of free-for-all for anyone who wanted to go over to support the opposition, to letting funds and everything else just sort of go off there as much as they wanted, you know, to now be trying to set themselves up as the big broker. I mean, the Turks we've seen in the past few years have been trying to set themselves up as, you know, the ultimate bridge power between the West and the East. And, you know, they constantly try to set themselves up as a peace broker in all sorts of discussions, be this across the sort of Muslim world, or be this in sort of some of the geopolitical, you know, shifts or alignments that we've seen. So, you know, I think the Turks are in some ways trying to have their cake and eat it. And I question how long that is sort of sustainable.
Well, let's just head a little bit further around the region now and briefly look at what's happening in Egypt before we go to the break. Several hundred supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood protested in cities today ahead of the trial of the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi, on Monday. And US Secretary of State John Kerry will visit the country a day before the trial begins. For Kerry, Jane, a really difficult moment. You know,
yes.
It's not the greatest outcome. They can't claim to be the great sponsors of democracy yet in Egypt. What do you think he wants to say before that trial begins?
The US has been saying all along that, okay, they're not going to try to reverse the coup, but that the government of Egypt now has to find some way to include the Brotherhood and to allow them to participate meaningfully in elections, because excluding such a large proportion of the population is not going to bring stability. That argument isn't being well received by the Egyptian government, who are portraying the US as being in a big pro-Brotherhood conspiracy. And there's a lot of anti-US sentiment now being whipped up by the Egyptian military, despite the fact that they get so much aid and most of their significant weapons from the US.
And Rafael, the story seems to have run away from the Americans, doesn't it? Because they had this fellow, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who came to power, and I think everyone thought he was going to be this kind of marginal figure, a transitionary figure, but he doesn't seem to be wanting to go anywhere. And this cult building around him is extraordinary. So do you think the Americans are being completely wrong-footed on?
I think they have. And I think, frankly, the Obama administration's approach to the Middle East in general has been somewhat wrong-footed. I mean, it's been very standoffish. And now occasionally they sort of step in specific places to where they try to assert some sort of authority or influence. And frankly speaking, it hasn't really worked in many situations that I can think of. Kerry sort of showing up there before this trial, it's not really going to sort of change much on the ground from my perspective. And I think the Americans have got an awful lot of work to do to try to rebuild their role in the region.
Brilliant. Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck, and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Rafael Panucci from RUSI will still be here when we return.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whisky connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whisky, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. The time is now at 18:23 here in London. And still with me is Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI. Now, from the Middle East to Asia, where China has blamed the recent attack in Tiananmen Square on terrorists, singled out now as the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. So what do we know about the group and how is the government in Beijing responding? Now, we've just actually been in Kashgar for Monocle for the next issue and looking at the kind of what's happening there with the Uyghur people. there seems to be lots of potential ethnic tension within China. Mm. First of all, we're not exactly sure whether they're blaming the right people now or if this really is the East Turkestan Islamic movement. But Jane, what do we know about this group and what do we know about what's going on?
Well, there's a wider base of discontent among the Uyghur people of China who see themselves as being marginalised and oppressed by the Chinese government. This particular East Turkestan movement is said by the Chinese government and by some other international governments to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. But sure, we don't know, you know, to what extent the right people have been arrested and to what extent this genuine terrorism problem is used to round up a wider range of dissidents.
How much does it scare, do you think, that the government in Beijing, what's going on? Because, you know, they must look at the history, actually quite recent history of somewhere like Russia, when you see that, you know, the USSR suddenly cracked apart, all these kind of all its Muslim states pulled away. We now have Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan. Do you think that that's what they really fear could potentially happen one day in China if they don't crack down now?
Well, I think that the Chinese government look at the Soviet model as the model not to emulate, you know, in sort of the halls of the party school. That's where they say, let's not do that and let's not copy that model. I think when we're talking about Xinjiang in Central Asia, Xinjiang has the people within it, the Uyghurs, are sort of more ethnically close to the Central Asians. They're sort of Turkic speaking peoples. They sort of look more sort of Turkish or Uzbek or something than Han Chinese, and they feel very different. And if you go to cities like Kashgar, it doesn't feel like you're in what you'd imagine be a Chinese city. Now, it has to be said, it's being slowly sort of bulldozed away as they sort of try to turn it into a Chinese city. But the Chinese government does this because they're trying to modernize the place. I don't think they fundamentally see this sort of fracturing, sort of Xinjiang breaking away. And I think very few people would say that that's likely to happen. Ultimately, the Uyghurs are a minority within a minority. I mean, you know, we're talking a population that accounts for less than 1% of the overall Chinese population and is scattered over a huge piece of territory. So it's hard to imagine that that's actually going to happen. But I think their concern here is the optics of this whole incident. I mean, you know, whether these people were organized terrorists, which they're now pointing to ETIM, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, which I would be careful to add is a name that the group itself does not use when it's referring to itself. It's very much one that the authorities use. They call themselves the Turkestan Islamic Party. And they're a very small group, and there is evidence that they actually exist, but there's not much clear evidence that they're able to launch sort of directed, focused attacks within China. However, what we're seeing here is, you know, these people who were Uyghur and appear to have come from the region to the city of Beijing to launch this incident, which seems to be very low tech, which would suggest that it's not a sort of big orchestrated terrorist plot from afar. But they were still able to crash this jeep under the big picture of Mao in the middle of Tiananmen Square. And people were able to get pictures of that out. The optics of that are terrible. I mean, we're talking about a city that's about to have the third plenum, which is one of the giant sort of Chinese conferences that happens. And this security gaffe has managed to happen. So I think they're probably concerned about it more from that perspective than necessarily from the perspective of being a potential for Xinjiang to sort of break away.
Well, I think whatever the movement is really called, somebody within it obviously understands symbolism anyway.
Yes.
Now, elsewhere in Asia, the fallout from the ever-widening NSA surveillance scandal continues. This time, allegations in the Sydney Morning Herald article yesterday that the US and its allies, including Britain, Australia, Canada and New Zealand, are using embassies in Asian capitals to collect electronic data. I'd say that's not much of a surprise, is it, Jane? If you had an embassy in Jakarta, you'd hope actually your diplomats were probably keeping a close eye and perhaps even a surveillance eye on what's going on. You know, maybe Indonesia is a little bit more settled, but many of those economies are not, and many of the Western governments really don't know what's going on. Are we really to be that surprised that it does happen?
I think it's less surprising than finding out, say, Merkel's phone is bugged. But nonetheless, I think the more that public opinion becomes aware of this, the more there are naturally people saying this superpower and its allies doesn't respect our sovereignty. So I think there is a kind of public outrage that's growing.
But they must know that China's doing exactly the same and probably the Russians are doing exactly the same. It feels a little bit kind of fake, the kind of, the hysteria around this, because everybody kind of does it. It's just that somebody got caught out. Don't you think you're looking at me?
I guess you're asking me, you know, are 7 billion people equally cynical as a bunch of political cynics sitting here in London? I don't know. I don't know that they are. I think some people will genuinely be taken by surprise. And that's why newspapers are betting that this is a story people want to pay to read on their journey to work.
If you were a Vietnamese or a Thai or an Indonesian minister, would you be surprised that somebody wanted to know what was going on?
Well, you know, again, I think Jane's right. We're sitting here cynically and we say this. I don't know necessarily they would. I think that if you look at some of the other stories that are starting to run and the level of public trust that is being eroded. I mean, you've got countries like Brazil that are talking about, you know, re-sort of configuring their internet infrastructure so that, you know, information stays in the country. I mean, that's going to start, if all countries start doing this, that's going to start to fundamentally change an awful lot of things. And it will, you know, has interesting questions which it'll raise. I think this whole sort of, what this boils down to is, you know, when we're talking about Asia, the thing I found funniest about this entire story is the Chinese have been absolutely loving this entire Snowden incident because it is just, you know, the Americans shout at them so much about cyber hacking and all this sort of stuff. And they're like, well, you know what, you guys kind of have been doing it a lot too and ha ha ha. So I think it does undermine America's position and ability to take the moral high ground. And actually that does count wherever you go around the world. And I think it does count quite a lot in Asia where at the moment you are having a bit of a struggle between, you know, is it China that's dominant power or is it America's dominant power?
Well, unfortunately, on that slightly note of cynicism injected by me, and I didn't mean to end it there. Look at you two, generous all the way. We are going to have to leave it there. That was Jane Kinnaman, who's a senior research fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, and Raffaello Pantucci, senior research fellow at RUSI. Thank you both very much for joining us here today on Aperitivo.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyoist. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's aperitivo. We're going to talk Iranian films. We're going to head to Vienna's renowned Leopold Museum and we'll preview what's coming up on the rest of tonight's show and maybe even peek the weekend lineup. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. Muslim Brotherhood supporters have staged protests around Egypt today in support of the deposed President Mohamed Morsi ahead of his scheduled trial on Monday. In Alexandria, 7 people were wounded after residents clashed with Morsi supporters before security forces intervened. Iran's foreign minister says his country does not seek a nuclear weapons program. Speaking at a 2-day conference on science and world affairs in Istanbul, Mohammad Javad Zarif called on the West to accept a peaceful uranium enrichment program for Iran. The head of the Pakistani Taliban, Hakimullah Massoud, has been killed by a US drone strike in Pakistan on Friday, the latest in a series of blows to the country's most feared militant group. And in Canada, Toronto police said they've obtained a video that appears to match one that allegedly shows the city's mayor, Rob Ford, smoking crack cocaine. But they won't confirm what the video shows or say if they are contemplating charges against him. Ford, however, insists he did not use the illegal drug. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And I think we're going to hear more of that Rob Ford story, aren't we?
Possibly. I think it's a good story, isn't it?
Well, I think the film is going to air soon.
Oh, really?
Well, I'm sure that someone's going to leak it because I think there are meant to be several copies of it. So.
Ah, okay.
Well, cool. We have quite a few Canadians in the building, so I'm sure they'll be keeping us up to date with Rob Ford's the allegations around crack smoking that are swirling around the mayor of Toronto. Well, welcome back to Aperitivo, live here on Monocle 24. The time is now 18:33 in London, which means it's 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. And let's turn our attention now to the cinema, and in particular, the films of Iran. Today, the 4th London Iranian Film Festival launches, and Monocle's Alexa Firmanich went to meet the festival's founder, Pejman Danay. On the agenda, the challenges of Iranian filmmakers, the unpredictability of state censorship, and how to walk a fine political line. Here's Pejman.
We pretty much have the best features, best actor, best script, best documentary from that festival. So you can tell We are representing a very good portion of the Iranian cinema today. But the movies to be looking at for us, obviously the Oscar winning director Asghar Farhadi's movie, which is called The Pass, and it's opening our festival tonight. It has won the Best Actress at the Cannes Film Festival, and it's going to be theatrically released in London early March, if I'm not mistaken, by Artificial Eyes. So that would be the one that I would certainly recommend.
Do we see any recurring themes in a lot of these movies that keep coming out over and over again?
The answer is yes. I believe it's the multicultural and complex stories. After a separation that won the Oscar, filmmakers have seen the potential in the non-Iranian audiences out there and their interest in complex stories coming out of the Middle East. Majority of them are social issues. They're very less political these days. But yes, that is becoming a very common theme, and we've seen quite a few of it. And there has been some very successful films and very successful stories carrying that theme.
And what about the political angle of it? What's the relation now in the country between the government and the film industry?
The relation is very complicated. When it comes to Iran or Iranians, everything, in my opinion, is political. You're either agreeing with the government and their policies, or you're either against them. Us running the film festival, we've tried very hard to stay on that very thin line in between, and thank God we've managed to, you know, stay there for 4 years, and it's been very clear to everyone who's against that you know, we are an independent film festival. For filmmakers, they have the similar kind of scenario. They've either got to be with or against, and then pretty much everything you say these days could be translated politically motivated and somehow attached or, you know, labeled. But considering there is a new government in place now, the new government has shown a lot of good green lights to the filmmakers. The House of Iranian Cinema has reopened after quite some time. So I can tell filmmakers are much, much more excited these days. Let's hope that, you know, the changes are to be made, and let's hope the next 4 years is a better, you know, season for Iranian cinema.
Is the government quite transparent about when it bans a movie and what the reasons are for this or not? Or do they just come out and say this movie is censored for all audiences and that's it?
I don't think any government is transparent about censorship, especially Iranian government. You know, there is no question about it that they're not transparent. But then again, filmmakers have learned how to make their stories that contain sex scenes, but they do it like a hidden sex scene. Do you know what I mean? So they have learned how to do things. They've learned how to physically find the way around doing what they want to do, saying what they want to say in the best way possible, but going around censorship. And that has, I believe, that has added value to the Iranian film industry, simply because Iranian films have been growing very fast, winning awards, because they had to deal with various challenges, find ways, clever ways of doing things and saying things. And I think the censorship has had a bit of value added to that. So yes.
And I mean, it's quite interesting. I've read some statements from the Iranian Minister of Culture, who came out saying that the industry is not living up to its full potential. What do you think about this?
I think he's absolutely right. The Iranian films, Iranian directors, they have a great potential, much, much more than what we've seen out there today. Not because they're Iranian and we're passionate about it, not because of that, because they have the poetry, they have the literature, they have, they've had the cinema in that country for over 113 years, because censorship has always been there. There are various factors that have, you know, been in place just to make sure the filmmakers have to push themselves to achieve. And clearly we know what they've achieved today. And having lived in that country for 20 years myself, I kind of know what they go through to make those films. And I personally believe he's right saying that there's a great potential for Iranian movies to be reached. So,
and how does Iranian cinema differ from other Middle Eastern cinema industries?
You see, it's very different. When you look at let's say, the cinema of Turkey. And when you compare it with Iranian cinema, you know there are directors coming out of that region that are doing an awesome job and they're doing a great job. It's very different. It's like you comparing the French cinema with the Italian cinema, in my opinion. So I see a lot of good movies and a lot of good things about the film industry happening in that region. As Iranians are getting more competitive, as Iranians are getting, you know, releasing more movies, better movies are coming out of that region. You know, others will push themselves as well. You know, they look up to Iran. In terms of movies, they look up to Iran. So when Iran raises the standard, they will have to raise the standards. And they've been doing a great job so far. So
if I'm watching an Iranian movie, how will I know that it's, let's say, Iranian and not Turkish? You mentioned the example of the French and the Italians.
I would say the Turkish movies will be much more European, much more colorful, much more sex theme or erotic theme would be much more colorful there. Iranians would be much more kind of broad, full of longings, a lot of drama, a lot of complications in the story. The humor of Iranian movies is much stronger, in my opinion, than the Turkish cinema. Turkish cinema is much more European, and they have that European kind of angle to it. But Iranians are still that, you know, Iranian kind of theme is very strong.
Are we seeing a lot of collaborations between Iranian cinema makers and the international producers?
Unfortunately not. The ones that are happening are arranged or done by the government bodies, because there are arrangements to be made, licenses to be obtained, and funds to be secured, right? And very difficult for independent producers who are producing some of the best award-winning Iranian movies these days. So no, unfortunately, not as many as it should.
Well, that was our cafe chat with Pejman Danay, founder of the London Iranian Film Festival, with Monocle's Lexa Firmanich. Up next, we're in Vienna. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Cookery books that leave a bad taste in the mouth? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
We're making porchetta sandwiches. It's a roast pork belly with some Italian seasonings. Just really simple, salt, pepper, fennel pollen. Simple, tasty.
I think food off a grill really just tastes exceptional. It's the sort of thing I like to eat, you know. Lamb, chicken, even octopus, squid, always tastes good.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
You don't make business lunches here. You come usually alone or with somebody that you know very well, because it's homey style. You have to feel familiar with someone to eat in such a place.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. The clouds have been gathering over Vienna's Leopold Museum for months over the future of its storied collection of works by the secessionist artist Gustav Klimt. Well, this week, the clouds broke. The museum's director, Tobias Natter, resigned citing concerns over the control of its Klimt collection. The row stems from appointments made
by the controversial Gustav Klimt Foundation and its closening ties to the Leopold Museum. The foundation is linked to the estate of Gustav Usicki, a Nazi propaganda filmmaker who was Klimt's illegitimate son and acquired many works by Klimt that were, it's alleged, looted by the Nazis. Okay, well, to unpick all of this mess at the Leopold, our news editor Tom Edwards was joined by Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley in Berlin.
The Klimt collection at the Leopold has its own issues. It's the founding of the new foundation. It was just in September that this the new foundation, which has only 14 works from Usicki's estate, it's called the Gustav Klimt Wien 1990 Foundation. And the tricky part is that the managing director, Peter Weinhoipe, the business end of the Leopold Museum, is the head of the foundation, which creates conflict of interest. And Tobias Natter just could not deal with this, and he stepped down on Monday this week.
Now, this is obviously a problem, Kimberly. What do you think that the sort of longer-term repercussions of this might be? Because it's obviously a wrangle, which I guess to some sort of art world insiders and to those of us like me watching on from another country, you know, it just makes a kind of a compelling story. But there's something more worrying here, isn't there? I mean, mismanagement of these kind of collections and the rows of this character in museums, they spell bad news for everyone, don't they?
They do, and the funny thing about the Leopold is that they had an instance in 2010 where they did pay an heir to an allegedly looted piece, and their PR image had really gone up through Natter also. He was appointed in 2011. He's a wonderful art historian. He was an expert on Viennese art at this period. Right now, it's a big question how they're going to deal with this managing director, to be honest, if they're going to keep him, if this really is a conflict of interest, who the interim director will be. Elizabeth Leopold is actually the widow of the collector Leopold, and she doesn't know what to do. She's old. So we're all watching and waiting.
Absolutely. And I wonder, Kimberly, I mean, it does seem to be a problem, not particular to Vienna, but it does seem to have, the city seems to have its, well, more than its fair share of these sorts of rows. What's in the air, do you think, in Vienna that we constantly see these directors ousted? You know, it's either funds go walkabout, or there's questions about, you know, restitution or provenance, as in these cases. Why does it seem to be such a constant problem?
I think the restitution issue is a bit unique. In the past 2 or 3 years, several other museum directors have been ousted in Austria. Peter Neuver at the MAC, he jokes about this now, but he threw a big party for his mother with public funds. There was Gerald Matt at the Kunsthalle, who had a whole bunch of different things happen that were similar. Some people just think it's time for the old blood to go out and the new blood to go in. I mean, Natter's case is different because he was very respected.
Well, I wanted to ask you briefly about that, because obviously he is now on his way, but his expertise, of course, was very highly regarded, wasn't it? I mean, do you think that ultimately this is just going to be a big shame for everyone, because this is a guy who really knew his onions and now, you know, he's not going to be involved anymore?
Yeah, there have been just today, for example, in the Austrian press, one of the top critics mentioned that it's a Schade in German, a huge shame that he's not there anymore. There's a lot of speculation as to if he has another job. I don't know. I don't think so. Hard to say. But he will be missed, of course. People who have that deep of knowledge of art at this period, they're few and far between.
Well, that was Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley in Berlin with Tom Edwards talking about a Viennese art world. It's time now for a bit of music. We were just in Austria, so let's stay on track. This is Jimmy's Gang by Parov Stella. Well, that was Jimmy's Gang by Parov Stella. Austrian, you know. Now, Aled, John, is here in the studio, so is Annabelle Bly and David Pleasant.
three of the producers, going to tell us about things coming up today and over the weekend on Monocle 24. We'll see who's got the best show. We're going to start with, not that it's a bit of a fight here, but anyway, Alad, you're producing The Globus Asia tonight.
First in the ring.
I'm ready for the spot. What's your killer punch?
So, okay, well, we've got some breaking news because in the last couple of hours it's been confirmed that the leader of the Pakistan Taliban, Hakimullah Massoud, was killed by a US drone strike. That is incredibly contentious, obviously, for a number of reasons. Nawaz Sharif was in America last week to talk about how drone strikes need to end. That's been a dialogue ongoing between Pakistan and America for some time, of course.
Well, make sure you've got a fresh angle because we did cover that at the top of the show as well.
Well, we're going to be talking to Imtiaz Taib in Islamabad. Did you speak to him? I hope.
No. We were. Our discussion was in the studio because it was actually just breaking news then.
Okay, fine. Well, we're going to be expanding on what little analysis you gave on it there, and then hear from a guy called Jonah Blank. He's from the RAND Corporation. It's a global policy think tank there, and we're going to flesh out the talks that Noah's had in America last week, the speech he gave in London yesterday. And figure out how America is going to move forward with Pakistan.
Because what we were dipping into is, which will be really interesting to hear from the Pakistan side, is, you know, that it kind of does derail their talks a little bit. You know, this idea that, you know, that they had a plan, they wanted to speak to the Pakistani Taliban, that the government felt that there was some kind of manoeuvrability there, and that kind of seems to have been literally kind of blown off the playing field as well.
Yeah, it's an incredibly tricky situation for both Pakistan and America. The drone strike kills someone who has killed himself over 1,000 people in the Waziristan region of Pakistan. But of course, drone strikes are an incredibly contentious topic for the Pakistan administration. So it should be interesting.
Good. Well, Annabelle, you're doing the daily.
I am.
And please tell me you're not leading with Pakistan.
I'm not.
Oh, good.
We do have breaking news as well.
Oh,
on
do
the
you?
Daily.
Hi, it's a battle of the breaking news.
This time from the west coast of the US, there has been a shooting in LAX. So there's actually a press conference going on right now.
Now, I saw that on the wires that the airport had been partially closed down. I'm not sure if that is
Yeah, it's
still
the Terminal 3 where it took place. I think it's still shut down. There are conflicting reports, different newspapers. It's all very unconfirmed at the moment. So we're hoping when we go to air at 2200 London time, we'll be speaking with our transport correspondent, Tristan McAllister, in the States, and he'll be giving us the latest on...
And from the initial reports, do we have any sense of whether it is terrorism or whether it is just a kind of a lone man with a gun?
No, the word terrorism hasn't actually been used in existing reports. It seems to have been one man with a gun who the LA Times, who seemed to have had a bit of a coup, they are saying right now that he was shot at the scene, but that is not confirmed yet. So we will find out.
Well, two great stories for us to follow this evening on Monocle 24. David Pleasant's also here, the producer of The Stack, our media show, all about print media, which goes out on a Saturday. And we've got a little clip, haven't we, David, from your show? What's this all about then?
Well, we'll be going to Paris, where unusually, perhaps Elle, a very women's wear magazine, of course, is launching a men's title. So let's hear about that.
Male versions of Elle magazine are sporadically published in countries like Canada, Romania or Hungary.
睿智风范魅力,
and in China, Elmen has become an extremely successful monthly.
Dans pas mal de pays, ce sont des suppléments, donc ça c'est différent.
In most countries, Elmen is still just a magazine supplement. But it's true that in China, it's a monthly that has had extraordinary success. It's really simple. The Chinese market is booming, and the magazine has taken advantage of that. In France.
Well, that's part of a report that's going to be going out tomorrow on The Stack, and that was the very fine voice of Daphne Denis, another one of our producer-presenters who you heard at the top of that. David, have you seen the magazine?
I have, and it's quite impressive. It's not quite as kind of mainstream, perhaps, as you might expect from such a kind of legendary title, kind of such an established title as Elle.
Well, because Louis also came out again in France not long ago, and there's a bit of a kind of, you know, when you look at Louis, it's more in the kind of tight tops area of men's journalism, I'd say. Whereas they're trying to be a bit more cerebral, aren't they? I think they're trying to say, you know, men have other interests, and it's always a kind of a brave thing to suggest, but then actually when you get on the news shelves, sometimes it doesn't quite work out like that.
Well, that's it, and that's the kind of question that I think we'll find out about tomorrow, whether it's really that there's the kind of the market to sustain that kind of interest. The editor of Elle Man raises the question whether men don't really want to find out about other men as much as they want to kind of talk to other men, is what he says. So we'll see whether they can kind of break the cliches of men's magazines, you know, whether it's kind of interviewing very sexy ladies or talking about Viagra addiction and so on, amongst the other topics.
Aled wants to know where the copy is now. He wants to borrow it after the show.
Well, they're the stories of the first issue of Elle Man from Paris.
Well, seeing as we did Pakistan, maybe you want one of those stories for your show. No, I'm joking.
We'll lead with Viagra and sexy ladies.
Okay. Well, thank you everyone for coming. Anyway, it's good to hear that France, anyways, is still investing in newsprint and believes in the newsstand, like Monocle does as well. Thank you to all three. That's Ali John, who's producing The Globalist Asia, Annabelle Bly, who's heading up The Daily Tonight, and David Pleasant, who's looking after the stack. Thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for, in fact, on Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jane Kinnamont and Raphael Pantucci. We've talked about many things, including spying. Everybody kind of does it. It's just that somebody got caught out. Yeah, you're looking at me.
I guess you're asking me. You know, are 7 billion people equally cynical as a bunch of political cynics sitting here in London? I don't know. I don't know that they are.
Well, she accused me of being a bit of a cynic, but apart from that, it was a great show. Today's show was produced by Daniel. It was researched by Alexa Firmanich and Lillian Hess, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Next up is The Menu, where we'll be chatting to an Australian man who's written a definitive guide to Vietnamese cuisine, and we find out about a hotel in Sweden for your sourdough.
I think we've had a bit of a food nerd trend among regular folks, not just among, you know, celebrity chefs or molecular chefs, and I think this is a part of it.
Well, this show will be back at the same time on Monday. But for this edition of Aperitivo, it's time to kind of say goodbye and just wishing you all a great weekend. And as I say, we look forward to seeing you all on Monday. Thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across 7 disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.